October 25, 1999. A Learjet 35 departs Orlando International. The destination is Dallas Love Field. Six people on board, including golf champion Payne Stewart. 4 minutes after departure, the crew checks in with Jacksonville Center. Routine acknowledgement, the Learjet climbs to 39,000 feet and levels off, then silence. ATC attempts contact repeatedly. Nothing. The aircraft continues northwestward on autopilot. The Air Force scrambles fighters. They intercept and make visual contact. The cockpit windows are frosted over with ice, consistent with rapid depressurization. Through one window, a crew member is visible, slumped over the controls. The Learjet flew on autopilot for nearly 4 hours. It crossed Tennessee, Missouri, and Kansas before it ran out of fuel over South Dakota and went down. Six people never had a chance, because by the time anyone on the ground knew something was wrong, everyone on board was already gone. I'm Tower on Radio Hangar. Today we need to talk about hypoxia, not the textbook version, the real one. The one where you feel completely fine until you don't, and by the time you realize something is wrong, you no longer have the capacity to fix it. Today's segment is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. Here's what you need to know about hypoxia, and the reason most pilots don't truly believe it even after they've been briefed on it. It does not feel like what you expect. Most of us carry a mental picture of oxygen deprivation from the movies, someone gasping, clutching their throat, clearly in distress. That is not how altitude hypoxia works. What actually happens is quieter and far more dangerous. As the oxygen available to your brain drops, the brain begins to malfunction in ways the brain itself cannot detect. Judgment goes first. You may feel relaxed, even euphoric. Colors can seem unusually bright. You feel capable, confident, maybe a little giddy. Some pilots who have experienced it in controlled environments describe it as feeling pleasantly drunk. And then, without warning, you're no longer capable of making decisions. The lights don't go out all at once. They dim slowly, without announcement. And by the time you notice they're dimming, you may not have enough function left to reach for the light switch. This is why hypoxia gets called the silent killer in aviation. It doesn't announce itself, it doesn't hurt, it just takes you, quietly and without drama. The number that every pilot flying at altitude needs to know is called time of useful consciousness. Pilots and military aviators abbreviate it TUCI. It represents how long after a sudden loss of pressurization or oxygen supply you have to recognize the emergency and take effective corrective action. Let me give you some numbers at 25,000 feet. Time of useful consciousness is roughly 3 to 5 minutes. That sounds like enough. It is not, because you'll spend a substantial portion of that window feeling completely normal. At 30,000 feet, TUC drops to 1 to 2 minutes. At 35,000 feet, you have somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds. At 40,000 feet, the military uses 15 to 20 seconds. And here's the critical caveat that belongs on every one of those numbers. They assume you're sitting still and breathing normally. The moment you begin moving, reaching for switches, turning your head to scan instruments, climbing around the cockpit to troubleshoot, your muscles demand oxygen. Blood redirects from your brain to your working muscles. TUC collapses. The physical act of trying to save yourself burns through the window you have left to save yourself. This is why emergency procedures for pressurized aircraft put the oxygen mask first, not the checklist, not the radio call, not figuring out what happened. The mask, because without oxygen, you will not be capable of doing the other things. I want to walk through what actually happens when pressurization fails, because this is not an abstract concern limited to airline operations. It is a real scenario for a growing segment of general aviation pressurized piston singles and twins, turboprops, the TBM series, the Piper M-class aircraft, the Cessna Citation family. Any of these can fail in ways that place the pilot in a hypoxic environment at cruise altitude, and the pilot may not know it until too late. The Payne Stewart accident remains one of the most haunting in recent aviation history because of what the radar track showed afterward. ATC lost communication. Fighters were scrambled, they made visual contact, reported the frosted windows, the slumped figure, and could do nothing. The aircraft just kept flying. It flew for nearly 4 hours, following the heading and altitude the crew had set. Crossed multiple states, eventually the fuel ran out and it came down in a field outside Mena, South Dakota. The National Transportation Safety Board's probable cause cited incapacitation of the flight crew members due to loss of cabin pressurization, for reasons that could not be determined with certainty. The damage to the aircraft in the impact was extensive. They couldn't establish exactly what failed, but the physiological chain that followed the failure was completely predictable from the numbers I just gave you. At 39,000 feet with no oxygen, the crew had perhaps 15 to 30 seconds of useful consciousness. They never had a chance to recognize what was happening and act on it. 6 years later, a Boeing 737 operated by Helios Airways departed Larnaca, Cyprus on August 14, 2005. That accident became the deadliest in Greek history, and its cause was mechanical, but its tragedy was entirely about the gap between warning and recognition. The night before the flight, maintenance technicians had performed a pressurization system check on that aircraft. During the check, the pressurization mode selector was moved to the manual position. It was not returned to the auto position when the check was complete. The crew boarded and began their pre-flight and departure checks. They received calls from ground maintenance about a pressurization warning light. The crew discussed it, but there was a problem. In that specific variant of the Boeing 737, the takeoff configuration warning horn sounds identical to the pressurization warning horn. The crew concluded they were dealing with a configuration issue, not a pressurization problem. They departed. As the aircraft climbed, the cabin altitude climbed with it. Passengers and crew began experiencing hypoxia. The oxygen masks deployed automatically from the overhead panels, which is the correct system response, but in the confusion and rapid onset of impairment, not everyone used them effectively. The captain and first officer were incapacitated in the cockpit. The aircraft, on autopilot, leveled at cruising altitude and entered a holding pattern near Athens. Greek Air Force F-16 interceptors made visual contact. Pilots reported the captain slumped over the controls, the first officer not visible in the right seat. One person on that aircraft remained conscious long enough to matter. A flight attendant named Andreas Prodromou, who held a private pilot certificate, managed to enter the cockpit. He made a mayday call, but the aircraft was already in its final descent, out of fuel, beyond recovery. It went down on a hillside north of Athens. 121 people, no survivors. Andreas Prodromou's mayday call proved he still had enough function to make it, but there was nothing left to save at that point. What those two accidents share and what makes them relevant to every pilot flying a pressurized aircraft today is this. In both cases, the initial warning was ambiguous or missed entirely. The crew of the Helios flight had received hypoxia training, but training in a ground environment had not given them a realistic enough picture of how it would feel in the cockpit, under workload, with no one pointing at them saying, "This is it, this is the moment." They expected hypoxia to feel like an emergency. It didn't. It felt like everything was still manageable until it wasn't. So let's talk about what you actually do about this. The first and most important tool fits in your shirt pocket, costs between $20 and $60 at any pharmacy, and works without any pilot action except clipping it to your finger. A pulse oximeter. These devices measure blood oxygen saturation. The measurement is called SPO2 at sea level. A healthy person's reading will sit between 95 and 100%. Below 90% is where symptoms begin to emerge in most people. Below 85%, cognitive impairment is significant. The value of a pulse oximeter in the cockpit is that it gives you objective data when your body is lying to you. Your brain cannot detect its own hypoxia. The oximeter can. A reading that starts drifting downward below 92% while you're flying is a signal to act, not a signal to see how you feel about it. The Federal Aviation Regulations spell out the minimum oxygen requirements under FAR 91.211. For unpressurized aircraft, above 12,500 feet means sea level. For any portion of a flight lasting more than 30 minutes, the required flight crew must use supplemental oxygen. Above 14,000 feet, required crew members must use oxygen at all times. Above 15,000 feet, the pilot in command must make supplemental oxygen available to every occupant. Those are the legal minimums. They are not physiological guidance. The FAA and the Aerospace Medical Association both recommend beginning supplemental oxygen use at 10,000 feet during the day and 8,000 feet at night. Because here is something most pilots learn once and then quietly forget: night vision begins degrading with mild hypoxia. Your eyes need more oxygen than almost any other tissue in the body. Flying at night above 8,000 feet without supplemental oxygen means flying with degraded vision. You may not notice it. That's precisely the problem. For pressurized aircraft, the calculation is different, but the vigilance requirement is the same. You are relying entirely on a mechanical system to maintain a survivable environment around you. When that system fails, time of useful consciousness is the only controlling variable, and the clock starts without any alarm to tell you it has. The emergency procedure for rapid depressurization has to live in your head before you need it, because you will not have time to look it up. Oxygen mask on immediately, not after you determine the cause, not after a radio call. The mask goes on first, because without it, you will not be capable of doing anything else. Once you have oxygen, initiate an emergency descent. You need to get below 10,000 feet, Every additional second at flight level 350 without supplemental oxygen is another second off your TUC. The aircraft is replaceable. Your passengers are not. You are not declare the emergency. Squawk 7700 ATC will clear the traffic. You get the airspace. The descent can be aggressive. Know the procedure for your specific aircraft before you ever need it. The technique varies across types, but the principle does not get down. What the accident record shows repeatedly is this. Pilots who recognize a pressurization problem early, don their oxygen, and begin the descent survive. Pilots who try to troubleshoot first, who wait to see how they feel, who don't recognize the problem until they're already impaired, do not. There is an environmental cue worth knowing. In a rapid depressurization, you may see mist appear in the cabin as the warmer, humid interior air meets the sudden change in pressure. You may hear noise, your ears may pop sharply. These cues are not subtle once you know to recognize them. If you see that mist or feel that pressure change at altitude, you don't wait for a second data point, you act. The slow depressurization is harder because there's no dramatic event to trigger recognition. The cabin altitude just climbs quietly, a seal degrading gradually, an outflow valve slightly stuck open. The result is a slow rise that can carry you past comfortable levels and into dangerous ones before any single moment stands out as wrong. This is why pilots in pressurized aircraft build the habit of cross-checking the cabin altitude indicator regularly throughout cruise, not just on climb out, not just when they think about it. Regularly, the same way you check fuel state and engine instruments. The pressurization system can fail in partial ways that creep up on you, and the instrument is the only thing that will show you it's happening before you start feeling fine in a way that should concern you. If you fly with passengers in a pressurized aircraft, brief them on the oxygen masks. Not as an alarm or a caveat, just as information. Every airline passenger in the world receives a version of this briefing before every departure. Your passengers deserve the same, because at altitude, if the masks deploy, you may be in no position to walk them through what to do. One more tool worth knowing about altitude chamber training, sometimes called physiological training or hypoxia recognition training, is available through military programs, through some civilian aviation training providers, and in a limited form through altitude tent simulations. The training exposes you in a controlled environment to progressive hypoxia and lets you observe your own personal symptom set. This matters because hypoxia does not present identically in every person. Some people get tingling in the fingers and lips. Some notice changes in color perception. Some experience headache. Some feel anxious. Some feel the opposite of anxious. The euphoria response is common but not universal. Some people get angry. Some people feel cold. Some feel nauseous. You need to know what your body does under hypoxia before you encounter it in the air, because your individual warning signs are the only early detection system you have, and it is not a loud one. Altitude chamber training doesn't give you a rating. It doesn't go in your logbook, but it may be the most useful thing you ever learn in a training environment that has no airplane in it. The accidents I've described today are not ancient aviation history. The Payne-Stewart crash happened during the careers of pilots flying right now. The Helios accident is within the professional memory of every working airline pilot in service today. These are not cautionary tales from a different era. They are reminders that pressurization is life support. And life support demands the same seriousness we bring to everything else keeping us in the air. A pulse oximeter in your flight bag. Oxygen procedures you can execute without the checklist because you have rehearsed them. A monitoring scan that includes cabin altitude every time you scan the instruments. Passengers briefed on what to do if the masks drop. That is the practical output of everything we covered today. The silence in that Learjet was not random. It was physics and physiology doing exactly what they do when we take life support systems for granted. Sources today include the National Transportation Safety Board, final reports on the Payne-Stewart accident, and on Helios Airways Flight 522, the FAA Office of Aerospace Medicine, and the Aerospace Medical Association. More at radiohangar.com. This is Tower. Stay current on your systems and stay out of that window.